decided to talk a little bit about civil disobedience tonight, because it's constantly in the news. Those of us who have watched television in the past week, we haven't seen anything out here, were, I'm sure, very upset and horrified at times to watch the police in South Africa with whips beating on the people who were marching contrary to the orders of the government. Not only were they being beaten with whips, but every week in South Africa in the past weeks, many people have been shocked, and there's severe strife. I haven't read the newspaper or heard anything in the last few days, but I presume that this is going on. And of course, the civil disobedience that is taking place in South Africa now goes from some of the villagers, some of the people in the homelands, and to Bishop Tutu, and to white persons, citizens of South Africa, many of whom are resisting their government. They have spawned in this country a sort of civil disobedience which is taking place in Washington around the South African embassy. And a good many Americans have been arrested for violating the territory of the embassy, which is another kind of act of civil disobedience. It hasn't resulted in violence as it has in South Africa, but it is a kind of act of civil disobedience. Carol and I live in northern Wisconsin. There is a grid in the earth that has been put there by our government, a radio grid, low emission, they say, whatever that means. It covers about 100 miles in circumference, which is the government is using to communicate with nuclear submarines around the world. And there are two problems. One, of course, is the nuclear problem, and the other one is that there is quite a bit of fear that this grid is emitting some kind of radiation which may be harmful to people. So a number of our friends in northern Wisconsin have, in protest, have encroached on the territory of this grid, which is in a rather remote wilderness area of northern Wisconsin, and consequently have been arrested. And a very fine young woman, the mother of two children, has spent 12 days in the Ashland jail for trespassing on the area of the grid. Well, these are just a few examples that are here before us of civil disobedience. And I know that this creates some deep-seated feelings in people all over the world. In our own country, people are split over this subject. Our president has taken a point of view, and as many people object to that point of view, many people support him. These issues tend to divide us and split us, and occasionally they erupt into terrible violence. Two areas of current at issue where there are acts of civil disobedience going on are one in Central America, where of course we're all aware of some of the things that have happened between government and persons who oppose the government. And then that has in turn spawned refugee people who have had to flee Central America and have come to this country, and in turn have spawned a movement that becomes contrary to the laws of our country, or at least the victims of the powers that be, in the form of the sanctuary movement. Carl and I participated in a kind of civil disobedience back about 10, 11 years ago, when I was involved with the American Indian Movement, which was a protest kind of movement, and got involved at the village of Wounded Knee, and ultimately was sentenced to prison for refusing to testify before a grand jury. So I also had some experience of holidays to be involved in a civil disobedience situation, and more than just being involved, the pain and bewilderment of trying to determine whether your act is a valid act or not, whether this is the way for a Christian person to act or not, whether you can, as a Christian, disobey your government or not. That's a very difficult and painful kind of decision to make. Well, Lois and Jerry have had some experience with this sort of thing, and I'd like to ask them to just say a few words about what they have seen and understood about civil disobedience and what that really means. Lois, you've had some experience with the sanctuary movement.
As I was trying to think what I would share with you all, I first of all said to Paul that I would have to give you a very personal statement. I cannot speak for the sanctuary movement as a movement. I don't know whether you're all familiar with that, but the sanctuary movement, sanctuary refers to churches that have declared themselves publicly to be open to illegal refugees, and therefore come under the focus of the law in this country, which is excluding Central American refugees as being illegals, and therefore, in a sense, are publicly harboring illegals. I can't really speak to that movement as a movement. What I can share with you that might be helpful are, first of all, the personal experiences and the struggle that Paul referred to, which is a very spiritual struggle of involvement with the refugee community. But before I do, I was thinking that perhaps the most useful thing to share with you is to simply say for most of you here that I really am the type of a kid that you'd like for your daughter or your granddaughter. I mean, this is goody two-shoes church lady to the top. It's kind of funny for me to be sitting here talking about civil disobedience, because even though I was in college in the late 60s and 70s, that was a great turmoil for me, but I was not really at that time politically active. In fact, most of my family was military, so the whole issue of Vietnam was very traumatic. The process that I engage in now is also not political in the sense that perhaps most people define civil disobedience. If you can, I'm a primary teacher too, so I'm pretty visual. But I thought there were just a few words. I'm also a linguist, so maybe this is useful. These have been sort of my process of figuring things out. And I'll explain what this is in a minute. And I thought maybe this would also be useful. Let's see if I can spell it. Disobedience, right? Disobedience. And I'm going to try something out by contrast. Let me just say what that means to me. My involvement in Chicago, in San Francisco, in the refugee community, I use the term refugee, and Jerry actually mentioned this afternoon, that's not really accurate, because in this country, these Central Americans are not accepted as refugees. So my involvement, if you want to call it criminal, or the church that I attend, is very much an involvement that grows out of, I think, a deep commitment to an understanding of the difference between what may be civil disobedience in terms of the present law structure of the United States and a very deep struggle with what it means to be obedient to the message of Christ that we proclaim and that we believe and the Christness that we try to live. Another way of looking at this that I think has actually influenced my moving into linguistics, and also in a way I think my beginning to move out of linguistics, is a discrimination between words in whatever form they may show themselves. Let's try out laws, if you will. And, whoops, this should be the word, the word. Sorry. Let me try and describe this, and again, it has to be a fairly personal account. When I first moved to San Francisco, I moved into the Mission District. The Mission District is probably 80 to 90% Central American. By that, I mean it is probably at least 80% illegal. People who have come, who have fled a war, who have no right to be in this country legally. I began to worship with the Spanish-speaking congregation of our church. There is an English-speaking congregation and a Spanish-speaking ministry. I chose to do that because of my own ties with Latin America, my own love of Latin America, and of the Spanish language. As I sat in the church congregation, certainly what was on my mind was not, is there, you know, what is the legal structure of the United States? What was in my mind is a worshiping body of people. And as the weeks went by, it became very, very moving to me to experience this worshiping community. For example, one of the most, Sunday after Sunday, one of the most moving experiences for me is prayer requests. I don't know what prayer requests are like in your church, but as I sit in San Francisco in the Spanish congregation, the prayer requests Sunday after Sunday are, I'd like to remember my husband who was assassinated 3 years ago. Could we please pray for peace in our land? Could we please pray to remember my children who are still in El Salvador. Death, destruction, almost, I don't know that a month goes by when somebody doesn't come in reporting another assassination of a close family member. As I began to worship with that community, I had real trouble putting together the words of our government with the word of the Christian message that we were worshiping together, messages of acceptance, of peace, of pain, of forgiveness. It just did not stack up at all. In the church that I worship with, the church has not declared itself publicly as a sanctuary. In a sense, that's almost a technical word, because the church, by servicing as totally as it does the illegal alien community, would be very ripe were anybody, North American, to choose to report it officially to the Immigration Service. I don't, and by that I mean that the church, and there have been such cases, and legal action has been taken against church bodies and church buildings that have harbored illegal aliens. I once asked, our church is now in discussion about officially declaring itself as a sanctuary. In a sense, there is a public stand that does make that an important stand, and I suspect St. John's will do that in the not too distant future. To me personally, what is more important is the active reality of the sanctuary that the church is providing. In addition to the worship service, probably the most active ministry of the church is what is called the Lutheran Latino ministry, and that on Saturday afternoons, a group of from 100 to 150 Central Americans will gather in the church basement, and what you have is a job co-op. I wish I could bring all of you in the presence of that COA. These people are not in this country legally. They have no right to work. They have no permission to work. If they work, it is done surreptitiously. If they work, it is done in the hope that nobody will raid their place of employment or report them. Obviously, they need to keep body and soul together. They need to pay a place for rent. They need to feed themselves, their family. Many of them are sending money to or collecting money to try to bring family members out of the pain of El Salvador, Nicaragua, well, not Nicaragua now, Guatemala. But in this job co-op, 100-150 Central Americans will gather. There are a few people who actively are trying to collect jobs and information, and the church publicizes its job co-op to other churches. Again, a risk. Whatever jobs come in, and usually there are approximately 25 in a good week, 25 jobs that will come in, and to watch 150 Central Americans go through their process of justly deciding and determining how 25 jobs will be divvied up for a week is a rather amazing and humbling thing. That particular group has an organizing structure which is Latino. And I would also point out that the war issues play themselves out in San Francisco and in the job co-op, and there's a lot of pain. I recently watched the election process of the directive of the co-op, and there was a slate that included Nicaraguans that were running against Hondurans, and there was quite a bit of national stress in the election itself. I don't know that that's surprising. I think it's perhaps, it's maybe more than we could assume that all of the issues that have come to boil in the war situations in Central America would not replay themselves also in this country. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Jerry, you want to say something about what you observed in Central America?
Well, I don't. I haven't thought. I guess I haven't thought really very completely about what my stance is. But my actions, I guess, show what my attitude is. I think basically I'm a chicken, and therefore I haven't ever participated in any outright civil disobedience act. It just frightens me. I mean, I get kind of uptight about the idea. I know I have friends that do that, and some of them sort of almost think of it as a socially acceptable thing, and they're in the circles that they work in. And that they are in. If you get arrested, it's sort of a good mark. But there are a whole, my observation is that there's a whole variation in that. Some things are pretty socially acceptable in the public to be civilly disobedient about, such as I think the apartheid thing is just a very obvious thing. And, but to take a stand against draft resistance, which a young man in our community just recently did, there's not very many people at all that will support that, and one pastor did. My personal reaction has been whenever there, I guess I'm wondering why I don't do acts of civil disobedience when it seems obvious that there is either a policy that I disagree with or a law, and it might be out of some kind of something out of my upbringing or something, but my reaction has usually been in things that I feel strongly about is more in the direction of going to try to do something about it. My wife and I went to, we felt very strongly about Vietnam in those days of the 60s, and But we didn't, I've never participated in a demonstration even in Vietnam. We went to Vietnam instead for Lutheran World Relief for 2 years. And we were in Nicaragua during the insurrection, and I've been in El Salvador. It scares me less to be in the midst of a war than it does to think of the prospect of getting arrested and get into that kind of process. So that's kind of my personal reaction. It isn't very clear in my mind even. So I can't really describe it all, but I think that my feelings are just as deep as some people who do, and I respect them deeply, particularly the ones that take the leadership, such as Daniel Berrigan or Jack Elder recently, who was arrested. And he's very much taking a very strong personal risk for you know, he's in the leader of the sanctuary movement in Texas. But that's just a comment for whatever it's worth.
Okay. As you can see, the whole area of civil disobedience is a very, very complex one. Lois is describing one kind of thing, he's describing something else, and my experience has been something else. By the way, Lois, you're a nice kid, you know. I was, you know, all my life I was a parish pastor and a social worker and above all an administrator. Which, you know, which is about as straight as you can get. I don't come at this thing either from a point of view of any kind of radicalism and so on. Nonetheless, there was a time in my life when I felt compelled by my convictions, as I think Lois pointed out, sacred obedience here and by the obvious injustice that was happening to a segment of people in our country, I felt impelled to resist the government. And that raises all kinds of feelings, such as you're expressing. I think that I have ranged from doubt to fear to fright to, just the whole range of feelings and thoughts and emotions over having to participate in that kind of an activity. Well, no matter how we feel about it, and I know that this is quite different for many people, as you can tell as we're just talking here, the fact is that civil disobedience is a reality around the world. And it forces us to tends to force us to take sides. Which in some ways is good and in some ways is terribly unfortunate. Because when we start taking sides, we become divisive. And frequently out of that divisiveness, violence erupts. And when violence erupts, it becomes much more difficult to reconcile the various aspects of the whole thing. So, we thought that what we'd do here tonight would be to just raise these issues. Obviously, in a one-hour session, we aren't going to solve the question of how Christians relate to injustice in the world. But I'd like to elicit now comments or questions or objections or support or whatever from you people so that we can begin to think through this thing together a little bit.
Can I just make a comment, though, to what Jerry said? And I think it's what I was trying to say with the involvement in a particular church. I think it seems to me that there are at least two different things being talked about in terms of civil disobedience. And for me, at least, I think it's pretty crucial. I also still have real difficulties seeing much purpose. And that's my own problem, I guess, with the big demonstrations. Affiliating now with Berkeley, there recently were big apartheid demonstrations at Berkeley. I keep trying to grow to understand the value of that. I think intellectually I do, but it's real hard for me to act on that. What I guess I wanted to say, and maybe it's most comparable to perhaps some of you who had kids or grandkids during the Vietnam time, is that the church that I attend has real human beings in it that sit next to me and worship with me and who ask about family members that are bleeding and homeland that is torn up. Somehow that's very concrete, and the English speakers in our church, many of them are people who might be at Holden this month. I mean, older people who have watched this neighborhood go from German to Central American, who theoretically probably have some difficulties with taking a stand if we labeled it civil disobedience. But who in the reality of St. John's Lutheran Church in the community called the Mission can reach out to real people and will fight to the end to say that we as Christian people in this community are here to serve real human beings in need? Somehow, I think that's an important, I don't want to say difference, because it probably isn't ultimately a difference. The demonstrations somehow also reach out and touch humans. I'm just saying openly, it's been a difference in my life. I find it, I am absolutely confident of the sacred obedience of what I feel and experience in my worship situation and my community. I'm still being real open that I'm not clear of this more broad social activist kinds of roles. That's still confusing to me.
Okay.
I'm very reluctant to speak, as you probably found out.
Talk anyway.
I appreciate what Lois has said very much, because it provided me with a insight which I hadn't had at all before in regard to the structure you put up, that the civil versus disobedience versus sacred obedience, and the framework in which you put that. You did say at one point was that you felt that what was going on was not a political statement. Or did I hear something that you didn't say?
What, I personally or my church or what?
Well, you said something about it being a political statement, and it wasn't. I remember correctly.
I know that's not conscious for most of us as we act, no.
Yeah, that's certainly is something that I really appreciate, because it seems to me that what we see in civil disobedience in our country, not what may be civil disobedience in South Africa at the present time, or this is an aside, I remember post-World War II, post-Hitler, how many people have censured the German people for not exercising civil disobedience in the name of Christianity against Hitler. But it seems to me what I hear, and partly is what you're saying, and it hasn't been said, uninferred, but what you are apprehensive about, where your doubts about this thing has come in, perhaps the threat that civil disobedience has to the political process in our country. And I feel that, I personally feel that we have a system of government which deserves to be very jealously protected as compared to what exists in many parts of the world. It may be imperfect. It certainly is imperfect, but it would be hard to construct a better one. And to protect that system, I think, is something that has to be given consideration, particularly in view of the fact that civil disobedience has become a mechanism also for programs and objectives of people who I feel very unhappy with. The national Aryan movements that are professing civil disobedience as a mechanism too. We have this in our general area, particularly lighted in Northern Idaho, a group of them. That form of civil disobedience, it's a Ku Klux Klan sort of civil disobedience. It has a real threat, it seems to me, to our structure of way in which we operate politically. We must protect, it seems to me, that political system which gives us the right to exercise ourselves by a democratic process and the private voting booth. And there's where I think many apprehensions would be in terms of this as a movement.
Okay. You mentioned the preservation of our democratic foundation of our country and the ability to participate in the voting process and so on. It seems to me that as I've watched acts of civil disobedience in our generation, not only in this country but in other countries, that most of them arise out of this deep sense of injustice, where the freedom to be the kind of participant in society has been denied in one way or another. So that when we talk about civil disobedience in this country and as a threat to the way of life that we have and the processes that we have for solving problems, we're not talking about a universal kind of situation, which may not apply in South Africa or may not apply in Central America or may not apply in even in our own country under certain circumstances. I think when I got involved with the American Indians, for example, it became quite apparent to me that most American Indians are excluded from the processes of this country to try to remedy injustice, politically and socially and otherwise, so that there is no remedy in the sense that you were talking about.
I understand that and appreciate that. As I think I told you, I applauded your the time when I read about your position that wounded knee, and so I really did applaud that. And I applaud what is a number of these congregations are doing under rather stressful conditions in terms of harboring fugitives. That's what I think the term that is used in it. I had some difficulty with the application of the term that I heard from above here, with the term of a deviant.
Of what?
He has some problems also with, I mentioned the Aryans. He probably did include them as being deviants. I hope so.
Did you use the term deviant?
I was referring to your Aryan.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm sure he did. Because I guess he's somebody who doesn't agree with me, you say.
I think Thoreau was arguing that you do need civil disobedience in the American system to point out certain things the government's wrong, to
opposition.
Use all that tax to build nuclear weapons. Maybe it is to, for some individuals to refuse to pay that part of the taxes.
One of the things that strikes me in this discussion is, I guess I want to ask, it seems to me that one of the questions is, what is it that we choose to civilly obey at this point? I mean, I just see some real conflicts, at least in the Central American situation, where you've got some international organizations like the UN openly claiming these people to be refugees. You have a Statue of Liberty and statutes in this country also claiming to be open to those in need. And then you have other words, and this is why the conglomeration of words is significant. There are words and words and words that spin out a network of stuff that forms civil obedience. And so even on the civil question, I think it becomes very confusing. Recently, I've started working as a translator with a group of lawyers in San Francisco, and I'm sure they exist at other places, who can volunteer their time pro bono to work with Central Americans who have been picked up by the Immigration Service and are incarcerated in process of deportation. Now, if anybody knows the civil laws of this nation, one would hope that lawyers would. I attended a training of over 100 attorneys in San Francisco, tax attorneys, family lawyers, whatever, who spent an entire Saturday being trained on the muckety-muck of immigration law. And the lawyer I worked with, a gutsy young labor lawyer, son of Jewish immigrants, told me that he has just seen certain populations of our country so creamed by the legal structure, the civil law of this land, that his intent was to get in there with the magic that he knows as lawyers and to really try and use those laws in the way that he feels deeply committed civilly They need to be used on behalf of people that this country claims to be standing there to welcome and protect. So the issue, the words of civil law is very confusing to me. The other side of it is, I think this, the sacred obedience. And that's also a little confusing. I'm not over here, the word, I have no clear definition of that. And I think that's the other side of my, what I was trying to say. I, as an individual Christian, and St. John's as a community, does not have any clear vision of what in Nell's Bells we're supposed to be doing in the mission district surrounded by illegal fugitives. But I think what we've tried to do is almost person by human person, first of all, say you can't be shipping people back to certain death. That doesn't fit our understanding of the word. And almost decision by decision, moment by moment, figuring out what it means to be the word in that community. Probably making some mistakes. And somebody may civilly cream us for that. But I think that's part of the process of figuring out. That's a lot of words.
I imagine William Stringfellow, however, would, if he were still with us, would probably approve.
I would probably appreciate that.
If I believe that something is morally wrong, then it's immoral for me to do that. You know, and if I believe that in paying taxes to build nuclear bombs and to support the oppression of and murder of peasants in Nicaraguan cotton and coffee fields, you know, if I believe that is wrong, then I believe it's immoral. Then it's immoral for me to pay those taxes. That's breaking the law, and it seems very clear, you know, what action I should take. And the distinction between sacred obedience and civil disobedience, well, it's obviously sacred disobedience to write the check. I mean, and it does put me up against some tough decisions, and but I think it's very obvious what I should do.
Have you thought through any kind of criteria by which you make those moral judgments? And then secondly, any criteria by which you can judge your own action?
My own personal whatever religious beliefs regarding, you know, the survival of the species is a very, that I believe that the human family is at risk right now, and that we continue to move towards that, and with the continued nuclear arms buildup, and that's definitely a criteria. You know, does it promote the end of our species and the end of our planet and the plants and animals on it? That's certainly a very definite, and the teachings of Christ about how to respond to your neighbor, to your enemy, you know, it seemed very clear too, that, you know, they ask for your shirt, give them your coat too, or whatever. I mean, obviously, matching bomb for bomb is not in adherence to that teaching. So those are a couple of criteria. Mm-hmm.
I think before we get in too involved in acts, or especially when that we need to take a look too on the other side and view what's good about our system of government and the minute part of it that we object to. Is it, how much worse is it to disrupt the whole system because of the small portion, when this amount of good is also being done at the same time.
Okay.
I was at the Senate convention in L.A., and one of the speakers there says, I was in the group that was objecting to everything in the 60s. He says, we see now, looking back, that we were misinformed a lot of times, and we might have had the right idea, but we realize now we sure went about it the wrong way. So he kind of cautions us, be sure and take a second look and make sure that you had your facts straight. Now I know of a case with the labor movement with Chavez. There was such a distortion. The American Lutheran Church was sold one idea, and people from American Lutheran Church pastors that knew Chavez personally, they worked with him personally, he says it is not like it was sold to the group in the Midwest. So it kind of, it's a hard question, I know, but sometimes I think we don't have all the facts.
What no. was it like?
What?
What was it like? If it wasn't like what we heard in the Midwest, what was it like?
They were not oppressed, and they were not underpaid as much as they tried to make a thing. He says some of those workers are making more, twice as much than I'm making as a pastor. And he says, I'm not destitute. They were having, he said, there were a lot of buildings of the were burned. And he says to Chavez, he said, I thought you believed in nonviolence. Chavez had shrugged, well, sometimes you have to get rid of that. And he knew Chavez personally. He worked with him. He was an American Lutheran Church pastor. And he very much disagreed with Chavez's way he was going at it. Chavez tried to come to Arizona, the copper industry this one, stir up trouble. They told him we want no part of it. They sent him back.
Who's they?
What?
Who is they?
The people in Arizona, even the workers in Arizona, the copper workers in Arizona. It was a union struggle. And the people voted to do away with the union. They said the union is not interested in helping us. The union is only interested in their own power. He says, we know we have to take a pay cut, and they would not let them take a pay cut, so the mines were closed. Now, who was better off, working for $5 to $6 an hour or not working at all?
I think maybe you're not quite talking about civil disobedience. You're talking about
he was trying to get civil disobedience on some of the laws.
I think that you're talking about a complex situation in the labor movement, which didn't necessarily impinge itself on the laws of the United States. In some instances, it may have done so, but I think it's a little different. It's a kind of situation that you're talking about. Although there are certain parallels there, no question about that. Okay.
One of the things about the sanctuary, you know, my understanding, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that it isn't so much that the law is bad. I mean, there is allowances in the laws for accepting people as refugees, or for giving them extended voluntary departure, is what it's called. I mean, they can stay in the country if they're given a certain status. It's an interpretation of the law that's on the books. So people that feel that the laws should be enforced in the spirit of the way they were legislated in the Congress, they feel that the administration is not interpreting the law the way in the spirit in which it was legislated. And so they're pushing for the proper execution of the law that exists. In other words, there is ways, and there are in Congress right now, in our church, and most of the denominations are asking the people in the churches to advocate this, that that a proper application of the law be made, an interpretation of the law for the good of making it possible for Salvadorans to come in as refugees, just as we make allowances for Polish, Cubans, and other people.
The percentages of applicants for political asylum from East Bloc countries, communist countries, the percentage of those that get accepted is enormous. The percentage of those applying for political asylum under grounds of clear evidence of fear of loss of life in their own country from Central America is minute. It's like under 3%. And it's in this process with the lawyers. The lawyers committee that was training these 100 attorneys actually handed out a manual where they had a pro forma form that the lawyers could Xerox and send in to the State Department. Every application for political asylum, a copy must be sent to the State Department. And they announced publicly, this form will come back, it will be denied. There's too little people in the State Department that deny every Central American application. Matters not what the evidence is, matters not what the situation is. The only place, at least in California, that you have any hope of a political asylum rendering for a Central American is actually in the courts. So, and that's after the form has come back from the State Department saying denied. In the courts, if you can present a strong enough case with corroborating evidence, and God knows where people are going to get that since they leave with nothing, but if you can come up with that kind of stuff, then you have a prayer, depending on who the judge is and if he had a 3-martini watch. I mean, it really, I am not a person who came into this with this kind of bias about the legal system. I really do believe in the American flag, motherhood, apple pie, and those things. And it was probably the first moment when I saw our client come off of an elevator in handcuffs, out of an elevator that said, no people, baggage only. There was something about that, and then the court system itself, and I was just appalled. The attorney I worked with was told by the judge, counsel, this is a different world in immigration. So whatever else you may do in court, this is a different world.
I think this has brought up another kind of issue that touches on what I think you were talking about earlier and what we need to consider, and I think something about what you've been saying, and that is that it seems to me that in this country at least, and possibly in other countries such as in Central America, the issue is not really whether those who are civilly disobedient are breaking the law, but whether they are really opposing something that has been illegally laid on people. Again, I have to refer to the American Indian people. Court after court decision, now, 10 years later, has indicated that the government was in the wrong in enforcing certain kinds of laws, and that the powers that be had misinterpreted the law in order to accomplish a certain goal. And in the restoration of those rights have angered a great many many people in this country. I think of some of the countries in Central America, for example, where the governments avow that there is freedom of speech, freedom of movement, and so on, and have it even written in their constitution, but which deny it completely in the application of police force and so on. So that I think the question of civil disobedience becomes a very moot question when you take a look at who really is disobeying the law. And even our government at times is capable of disobeying its own laws. And I think that thrusts Christian people and those who are interested in justice into a very difficult dilemma in trying to thread this out, because most of us don't have the expertise in interpreting those laws for ourselves anyway. Okay, any other comments? Yes.
Whether it's civil
disobedience. We've got about 5 minutes, okay. And then
whether it's civil disobedience or any other law you go into court about, I think our laws are interpreted in many different ways. And I do think we should be very proud of our country, and we do have to start at our local government and be active there, or we can't change anything.
Okay. Good.
I think we've all
enjoy the benefits through civil disobedience way back from the Boston Tea Party and from Martin Luther King and from other, but the issue is the thing. I think we all object to the police beating up people, the blacks in South Africa. But then when, oh, a year ago, exactly a year ago now, 1 year ago, there was a Catholic priest here, right in this room, and he was in a rowboat trying to stop the submarine from coming into Bangor and Puget Sound. I thought that was a stupid act, and I told him so. But then they also, you can stop the train coming in there by getting on the tracks because they'll stop. But a submarine won't stop for a rowboat. that is stupid. But it depends, civil disobedience depends on the issue involved. There's some issues that aren't very valid, they're not the right setup. But we've all enjoyed things through history because somebody stuck up for their rights and did the things contrary to what the law of the land said.
Very good, thank you.
Well, I would like to think of civil disobedience as not an act of disloyalty against our country, but actually as helping our country to better govern us. I've worked a number of political campaigns and trying to clean up City Hall. you can do it. Believe me, they say you can't, but you can. But I came to the conclusion that we get the kind of government we deserve. And if we just shrug our shoulders and worry about how we're going to pay our bills at the end of the month and whether to give our kids a new car for high school graduation, and don't bother to go vote and don't bother to read the editorials and don't bother to listen to the people and really research it, then we deserve what we get. And we can't have a good government unless we as voters are intelligent voters, informed voters. And I think our government needs to know when we are against what they're doing.
However, we can't come to the point where we take the law into our own hands. Whatever, there's every issue, somebody's for it, somebody's against it. And just because you're against it, there's no reason to take the law in your own hands and do something contrary to the law.
But I remember watching a television program where the officials in the White House and in Congress and so on looked out the window, and here were people protesting. And it really got to them. The remarks they made on camera, that was one thing they were listening to.
Was that civil disobedience, though?
Demonstration.
Yes, it was. It was a demonstration.
Well, that's not necessarily civil disobedience. Well, a demonstration. Unless it transgresses some kind of a law.
Well, you know, maybe they got their license to parade and maybe they didn't, but it was obvious that they were trying to tell somebody something and they were listening.
I think that's one of the confusion I've been hearing all night, is the difference between civil obedience and insurrection. And I think maybe we should define civil obedience as it's a deliberate breaking of the law, it's nonviolent, and you expect to go to jail for it. I mean, that's the purpose of it. And it's not bombing the mass center at Madison back in the 60s or early 70s. That was insurrection, that was violence, that was not civil disobedience. So we're not talking about armed overthrow of the government. We're talking about a deliberate breaking of the law and done in a nonviolent manner with the full intent of taking the consequences for it.
That's what I was trying to refer to when I referred to the criteria.
I keep hearing people thinking it's insurrection against the U.S. government, which I think that's another area.
And there's an interesting perspective on that, at least in terms of the Central Americans that I relate to. It is an interesting question if we stop and think about it. Why do they choose to come here, knowing that this is not a country that presently is doing anything to accept them as refugees? And when I have raised that question to the fugitives, I've never used that term, but I guess it's accurate, there's an incredible statement of hope about this government, that in spite of what is presently coming down as its legal stance and its deportations and the fears of all that, there is still this belief that somehow this is the country that can be hoped to come through for them at some time. And it's, although, as I recounted this afternoon or this morning, Canada is now, I mean, many, many of the refugees are now hoping against hope for Canada, because Canada is accepting refugees far more than, well, the U.S. is not. Central America.
I know Mexico is protesting our sending people back across the border who were entering illegally, and they had half their army down on their southern border, keeping their neighbors out of their country.
Well, we did not intend, as three people up here, to try to come to any significant conclusions. Obviously, this is such a complex subject that it's almost an impossibility. But we did intend to elicit some thought on our part, because I don't think we can come to a place like Poland, which is a place apart, and not from time to time confront some of the tough issues that confront us and our society. I hope that we have been able to evoke some thoughts on your part. Thank you.